day rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Pop Goes Present Songs of Freedom. My name is Matthew Bolin, and with me, as usual, is my co-host, Leanna.
Hi, everyone!
We're going to be talking today, as we hinted in the last episode, about MTV. I mean, this really started off, we thought of this as the next topic when, during the Occupy Wall Street movement, when it was still in full force in Zuccotti Park, there were a couple articles that came out that you had forwarded me that MTV was going to, one, try to do an episode of The Real World about Zuccotti Park, and two things that they actually did do, which was actually give an award on one of their shows for the best performance at Zuccotti.
It's ridiculous.
Or the best Occupy performance. And I really thought that these were joke articles at first. I was actually trying to look for additional sources, which, you know, which vouched for it, and it turned out that it was true.
Not The Onion.
No, it wasn't The Onion. And it was really odd. It made me actually think about, you know, what does politics have to do with MTV? Because MTV hasn't been known for its politics for a long, long while. We had mentioned, you know, just before we started recording, the fact that they did seem to play a role in 1992, especially in the Clinton-Bush-Perot election, and that, in a way, the Clinton seemed to be the first person who, if not, you know, obviously the MTV generation, happened to have an association with the age of Rolling Stone and rock and roll and something like that. And
he didn't inhale.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that just that statement alone probably resonated with the MTV generation.
Yeah.
Or even the generation prior to that more than any other presidential candidate.
Yeah, and that really started them on their choose or lose campaign, which has come and gone pretty much every 4 years. In terms of, you know, MTV and politics today, I thought that the whole thing and how they were going after, but dealing with the Occupy movement and trying to, in some way, attach themselves to it and the way they were going about it, it seemed to be a good jumping off point for what still exists in terms of MTV as a station that has anything to do with politics. And it's really hard to talk about it in a way involving MTV and music, because they've even taken music television out of their logo.
Exactly.
I mean, the M in MTV basically stands for nothing, except for the fact that MTV is a known quantity. But, you know, I thought that this was at least a good jumping off point for at least what we felt about MTV, both historically and currently, in terms of it being something to generate at least political thought in its audience.
Yeah.
And where it might be going, if it's not going to be doing it, you know, through playing videos from people with political, you know, aspects to their music and lyrics, then, you know, where does it fit in?
Well, I think it's probably helpful for me to just backtrack a little bit and give you my experience with MTV.
Okay.
And to see if we share it, because I'm not necessarily sure everyone does share it. First, you have to talk about the inception of MTV.
Mm-hmm.
I believe I had just turned 9 years old. and I did not have cable.
Mm-hmm.
So my first recollection of MTV was seeing about probably no more than 7 or 8 videos in rotation.
Yeah.
I mean, you could leave the TV and come back for an hour and see the exact same video that you'd seen.
Right.
And I remember that because I was at the house of someone who had cable and, oh, that's the famous MTV that I keep hearing on the news came out. And, you know, again, my 9-year-old brain seeing Steve Miller Band's Abracadabra video over and over and over again over the course of a few hours in this person's house. And, you know, thinking what a great concept it was to have television that was based on all this music that I liked. And no, my parents never did end up getting cable for a very long time. In fact, I think they just skipped cable and went straight to satellite. But in the interim, and as I was growing up, when I would go to the homes of people who did have cable, it was very exciting to see its transformation from that channel that had 8 videos in rotation to the one that had Kurt Loder on it.
Yeah.
And having MTV News. And of course, MTV News at first began being only news about the music that they actually shared on MTV. But I think it evolved into something else, and inevitably it would have evolved into something else, wouldn't it have? Because, I mean, when you think about the music, the content of the music alone has to inform what the political temperature is or what social issues are of the day. Am I right?
No, I think that is true. One of the things that really stands out for me is I believe they hired... I know they hired Loder after we got MTV, which I think was like in 1986 in my household. And I think they got him in... I think he joined in like 87 or 88. But I remember that it did sort of change because this was an individual who came from Rolling Stone, which at this point, you know, was a transformative thing in terms of, you know, sort of baby boom culture and music and things of that nature. And he gave a little more of a sort of an older, austere seriousness to the channel. And seemed to be a good fit in terms of it sort of branching out and maybe actually getting a little bit more of a older audience. Whereas today you have sort of the opposite going on. And while the 18 to 34 demographic has always been the main target, I heard somewhere that MTV now is basically trying to focus on trying to get the 12 to 17 demographic.
That makes a lot of sense if you think that the tween market is... But they're the largest consumers of entertainment.
Yeah, and in a society, especially in a society that's been in an economic downturn the last few years, they're one of the few in which you can actually think that they might actually have anything resembling disposable income on a regular basis.
Exactly.
Because they don't have to worry about things like, as much about, you know, regular expenses when they're living under their parents' roof.
Well, in fact, that was the statistic I wanted to quote, was that I read that it is the tween market that has the most disposable income in the United States.
Yeah.
So that's actually what I meant to say.
Yeah, but the thing I remember is that, you know, at the end of the 80s, they actually did have some sort of, like, wrap-up special where they talked about, you know, they talked to various people, usually in the music industry a lot, you know, buffering in between various clips of things that had gone on in that decade. And it did seem that, although it wasn't taking a hard news line with it, it at least was sort of looking at the outside world with some, you know, a perspective that fit into, you know, the generic attention span, so to speak, of the MTV generation, and trying to give... you know, a somewhat serious summarization of, you know, the world around and our place in it and things of that nature.
Well, I think that part of that, and it's something that I've never found a succinct response to, but I postulate that the whole political spectrum and era of MTV, so maybe we want to summarize when was that, really? I mean, beginning, say, around 88 through about 93, 94.
Yeah, probably from around the time that Loder came to, halfway through Clinton's first term, I think, was probably the peak, those 6 years or so, in which they, I think they tried to branch out as a channel that had more connections towards nonfiction culture, as opposed to...
And what I want to postulate is that that was one stepping stone in MTV trying to find itself before the sale to Viacom. My guess is that from the beginning, when they were still only doing things like playing videos on rotation, that certainly the people, the thinkers behind it and the directors behind MTV were probably already wondering what the channel would evolve into. Because certainly, if we look at the grand picture, I would imagine that they did not aspire to be a 24/7 video outlet. I'm sure they wanted to vary it somehow.
Right.
And in their quest to define themselves, they came across politics and the cross between politics with music. I mean, I think about, again, in the early years of MTV and, you know, Sting and singing The Russians Love Their Children Too and the Cold War and all of the music that came, pop music specifically, that came out of that time. And how that was a great segue into politics and social issues.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know how they would have changed naturally, but I think they sort of stumbled. One of the big moments early on for MTV was the fact that they sort of tripped over Bob Geldof.
And good point.
And the coup of being able to actually broadcast part of the Live Aid concerts in 1985, which in retrospect now is a bit infamous, because one of the I think one of the memorable moments to people who follow the history of MTV is the fact that the VJs, especially I believe Nina Blackwell, couldn't stop talking over the acts that were playing. They couldn't quite figure out how to actually... They couldn't even quite figure out how to broadcast a concert without sort of getting themselves in between. You know, where do we talk about the message? Where do we talk about, like, letting them know that the MTV is doing this, etc., etc.? And so I think that they sort of were dragged into having to sort of speed up the transformative process in 85, and they sort of, you know, between then and when they hired Kurt Loder, started to sort of work it out. But it, obviously, within the first 4 years, because I believe they actually started in 81, so in the first 4 years, they still hadn't figured out quite, you know, what it is that the VJs are really supposed to do, I think, other than sort of being your regular sort of... I mean, when it started out, it basically looked like a public access show,
where you
had, like, these studio hosts, and they're supposed to be somewhat of a... you know, a hip quality to them, but these were basically people that were, you know, involved on, I think, former disc jockeys, or they were involved sort of on the fringes of radio and television, and were being sort of kicked up to MTV. And they had really, I think, until sometime after Live Aid, I don't think there were any changes in the cast of the original five.
I mean, I wish I could remember the name of the one VJ that had a decent amount of TV experience before he started MTV. Right. I keep remembering him as the cute blonde one.
Yeah.
And it wasn't Adam Curry, so.
No. But that is interesting that, I mean, you could also talk about, speaking about Adam Curry, is the fact that you could also talk about at some point, you know, as MTV grew, the idea of the creation of celebrity in terms of it being, you know, attached to MTV, and how they went from the personalities actually being popular, especially in the early on, in the case of Martha Quinn, to actually the VJs themselves having this cachet of fame that were being built up more and more, and then sort of being sort of expanded on to the point where you have now, where you have people basically becoming famous because they're on an MTV program.
Well, Kennedy comes to mind.
Yeah, she was one of the early ones where she sort of gained infamy or whatever
for being Republican.
For being Republican,
shocker.
Yeah, for being Republican. And but you know what I remember is because actually she was, I mean, she came from K-Rock out in Los Angeles, which was the big alternative station, and I was out in Los Angeles actually at the time, I think, when she was hired. So she was, I mean, she's one of those people where I think I remember that you couldn't tell how much of her talking about being a Republican was actually real or it was a pose in terms of,
oh yeah,
you know, trying to create.
She was a contrarian.
Yeah, trying to create the site. Well, I mean, she like appeared like in a Rolling Stone spread, like naked on a horse, one time. And I'm just like, and you found that too. Like, I think, and there's like a couple of people like in the early seasons of The Real World. It's like, I'm conservative, but I have a wild side. And the whole idea of like that, where it seems in a way sort of like manufactured controversy in terms of this thing of like,
but even that was novel.
Yeah, it was.
Compared to what...
It was when it started out, which makes it like really interesting to actually talk about. You know, I think the whole thing about how they were trying to sort of a way that I called it glom on to the Occupy movement seemed a lot more, you know, it ironically stank of the corporatism that was being protested in the Occupy movement. You know, it was the type of thing which actually, you know, you could see sort of the wires and the pulleys going on in terms of the thought process behind let's do these things.
But isn't MTV, and hasn't MTV always been mired in some kind of deep set irony? And I'll, you know, going back to the beginning, think about those early songs. Think about MTV Get Off the Air. Think about Zappa. Think about all this music. Neil Young. Anybody who's ever referenced videos, who's ever referenced corporatism specifically as it is displayed on MTV, did it a long time ago.
Yeah.
In its inception.
Yeah.
And yet, here we are, all these years later, yearning for the MTV that those people were protesting for being too corporate.
Yeah. I think it's one of the first pieces of real irony, I think, in terms of it, was the fact that on the back of the Money for Nothing video and its now an incredibly quaint computer animation that not only was MTV playing a song which in a way was sort of criticizing the made for MTV acts that were going on, but it helped Dire Straits become for a period of probably about 8 months to a year or something the biggest band in the world.
No doubt.
I believe the final worldwide sales tallies for Brothers in Arms is somewhere between 12 and 15 million copies sold.
I love that you know that. What I find so curious about the case of MTV is that all these years later, I think it's still trying to find itself.
Oh, it certainly is. It's gone really, and I think maybe at this particular point in time, it might be starting to go through, and this may be me searching for something that's within myself as a nearly 38-year-old person, rather than, you know, who has a history with MTV, rather than as an impartial observer. But it does look like they may be starting to go through another sort of, if not moral crisis, then a crisis in terms of exactly what their place may be.
An identity crisis.
Yeah, an identity crisis. That's exactly. Because, I mean, they really have become most notable nowadays for two programs which are really more infamous than famous in terms of the Jersey Shore and Teen Moms.
Right.
And the question really has to be, especially if you're going for a, you know, a 12 to 17 audience, is do you, you know, how much of a responsibility do you take? And, you know, this isn't being said as, I tend to think of myself as moderate, so I'm not coming at this as a prude, but you know, there is a significant enough population in the U.S. that moves from to moderate right than moderate left. And I think overall MTV has probably placed itself in terms of moderate left more than the other way around. But you have these two shows which, especially with Teen Mom in the beginning, right from the beginning, I always felt uncomfortable in terms of the fact is this really doesn't seem to be a documentary because the people on the show are like unwed teen mothers who are like becoming celebrities because of the situation, and they're appearing on the covers of Us and OK and a lot of these people-type magazines and
30 Mile Zone, TMZ.com and all that. And then they're also getting into tremendous amounts of trouble.
Yeah, and you don't see... And I have not heard anything about MTV actually coming in and saying, look, don't do this.
Why would they?
It sells. Right. But, you know, I'm thinking maybe there might... If there isn't already starting a point, there might actually come a point that says... Maybe we're not handling these particular things the right way. Maybe we don't want to be identified by an entire sort of generation, because it seems to me that the generations of MTV watchers, you could probably break them down. They become smaller and smaller in terms of it, portions. Like, you know, I'm probably from the same generation as my brother, who's 8 years younger than me, but we're different MTV watchers in terms of generations.
Yeah.
And do you want to have a whole generation or multiple generations associate MTV with unwed teen moms and pseudo Guidos and things of that nature?
Now, I haven't seen either of the shows, but I don't know. I guess I'm very cynical. And it's funny because now the tables are turned. The other day we were talking about how I was less cynical about the approach that they're taking right now, or that at least they're starting to take.
They might be starting to take, and this is the thing. They've always had this show off and on called True Life, which is like their remaining extension of what sort of their documentary series were. Their own investigation, their news, the extension of their news department. It's like what remains of what basically is their news department in a way, with the exception of occasional still like bumper things about,
and they broadcast Dan Savage's It Gets Better.
Yeah, and the conversation we had about it is that from your perspective, I think you were taking a more hopeful thing because it seemed that it was, you know, maybe moving forward in terms of, you know, more diversity in terms of topical broadcasting.
Well, I think these things move in tandem with what's the word I'm looking for, with the social. With the times.
Yeah.
I mean, it is taking the temperature of the status quo.
Yeah.
And I think when things are comfortable, not when things are comfortable. But there's definitely been this trend towards, well, I want to call it bread and circuses, right? Not just MTV, but with media in general. I mean, the reality shows all across the board, and they just get more sensational, more outrageous. Just how much can we push the envelope? How many drugs can we feed a toddler and make her stupid things dressed up as a hooker? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, even mainstream news organizations now lean towards opinion journalism than investigative journalism.
Absolutely. So this is just a trend across the board. You know, as that, I think, is coming to a crescendo, given how much more can we possibly do?
Yeah.
Within the scope of, or the limitations of the FCC anyway, to garner ratings.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we can do very much anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, save just have an orgy on TV, which I'm not ruling out. But I think at some point, audiences become jaded. And then they start to look at other directions or things that they haven't seen have come around for a while. And so in that context, I wonder if perhaps it's not only possible, but even logical that MTV would go back to having some kind of social consciousness programming, more politically minded programming, if for no other reason than that everyone's feeling it right now. I mean, whether you're 13 or you're 35, you know that times are kind of tough, and maybe mom and dad aren't doing as well as they used to be.
Yeah. And maybe it is like that. The cynicism that I tended to have, especially regarding the It Gets Better special, they had a needing to see more than this for me to sort of release my complete cynicism, was basically based upon three points. One, that it's, that this was just a one-time special rather than a new series in which they were actually going to deal with LGBT teens and young adults and things like that.
Yeah.
The second one was the fact that the link that you forwarded to me stated that the special had been broadcast the day before, and I hadn't heard about it before it was broadcast. And,
right.
You know, I even read Savage Love, you know, in the Village Voice, and I can't remember Savage actually referring to the special upcoming in his columns.
Okay.
He may have done it on his podcast, but I haven't listened to his podcast actually in quite a while.
All right.
And then there was the third thing, which was that the original video that Dan Savage and his husband had posted on YouTube was exactly 17 months prior to the day that they did this special.
True, it's
and it seemed to me that there was this long time that the sort of the momentum behind the It Gets Better movement, while it still continues, had really seemed to have peaked about 8 to 12 months previous to this special, which seemed that along the same lines as sort of them tripping over Live Aid in a way that they were
yeah.
still getting adjusted to the possibility of, you know, tripping over maybe Dan Savage
yeah.
and realizing that, oh, maybe, you know, there are actually these issues that are quote-unquote more serious that our 12 to 17 audience does deal with that maybe we should be addressing. They just didn't. By the time they tried to, I think, catch this particular wave, I think it may have already hit the beach.
Yeah,
a while
well,
back.
But isn't that true of a lot of things?
It is true. It is true. A little while things, but I think, and maybe it's my naivete, but I always felt that because it was a network that based itself so much in youth culture, and especially since it was now owned by a company conglomerate that obviously had all of these things involved with A&R and, you know, try to do cross-tracking over various attributes of their groups to make sure that they get the right stuff to them, whether that be commercials or programming or whatever, that they would end up so behind relative to when not just the beginning, but what seemed to be the real peak momentum of the It Gets Better movement
sure.
Was occurring. And so I would like to hold out hope that maybe they are turning a corner with this, but I don't know for now. I think I sort of wait on bated breath. But I mean, it's the same thing as like what I want to see them be versus what the direction they want to be in also.
Or even the direction that its current demographic wants it to be versus our generation, the Gen Xers, who remember
yeah.
it primarily as a vehicle for new videos.
Yeah.
I think that if, I mean, and this obviously we can, there's any number of articles and now a book written about how people are completely nostalgic for the old MTV. And how many times have you heard people our age say, remember when MTV was music videos and
yeah.
music television was actually music? And yeah, there's a great, I mean, yeah, again, going back to that idea that MTV has always had this mean streak of irony in it. Just
yeah.
how it's everything about its evolution, about how it's gone about trying to find its identity. I mean, I can kind of see now as we talk about it, all these, you can almost draw a line. They've always been maybe a slightly behind the pace with regards to what they were aiming for. Always taking the temperature of the youth culture without necessarily gauging it properly or even reacting properly or ideally to it.
It seemed at its most radical that it was always edginess, sort of, you know, seen through a corporate filter in a way. Things like, you know, wanting like their award shows to seem as though they were just like a big party. Yet when somebody did something that was spur of the moment, they usually got banned from future shows. Andrew Dice Clay dropping an F-bomb and then he got banned for life. And now they have people who do that. I mean, they've loosened that up. But then also the fact was that I think probably the most, you know, radically political band that was actually, you know, that MTV actually, you know, played, you know, regularly was probably Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
And they became most infamous in terms of their association with MTV for the fact that I think their drummer climbed up on a display at one of the Video Music Awards.
Okay.
And they couldn't get him down.
All day, all night, all music video.
Okay.
What if the Colbert Report and the Daily Show had been an MTV production? What if those had been MTV productions? What of its stance and its identity as music television, between quotes, do you think that people would identify it more with music than they do currently? Because I would answer that question, yeah.
I think there's the possibility of that. I think that certainly shows of that nature have a greater connection to, well, things actually involving the entertainment industry than say their blocks of reality shows do.
Well, I mean, I think specifically about Colbert because it's a political show.
Yeah.
Sure. It's a political satire, but it's a political show. And how many really important musical guests has he had on the show now?
That is true. That
everyone from LCD Sound System to Cat Stevens to the Flaming Lips has been on Colbert.
I think Colbert was where they introduced the newest touring lineup of Gorillaz.
I believe it.
That has two former members of The Clash in it.
Oh, you're kidding.
Both Mick Jones and Paul Simonon were in the most recent touring lineup of Gorillaz, and I think that was their first appearance on American television, was on the Colbert Report. So yeah, I think from that aspect, and they've actually started to incorporate, I know in the last couple of years, occasional musical acts on The Daily Show, although a lot less than on The Colbert Report.
But I just think it's funny that within the scope of this conversation, I think we're looking at Comedy Central having adopted much of what a lot of people would have wanted MTV to have adopted, or at least evolved into.
Well, I think Jon Stewart, I think the first iteration of his talk show, which
you watch it.
Yeah, but didn't it actually start out on MTV before it moved to syndication?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it did. I remember seeing it on MTV.
And so there was another show that they tried doing for about a year or so called The Big Blank Show that had a rotating, like, guest hosts for the week, and they would have musical acts, and then, you know, it was much closer to your variety/talk show type thing.
Okay.
And I think it played, I think around, it was like an 8 p.m. type show, so it wasn't trying to compete directly with things like Johnny Carson or Jay Leno, depending upon when it came out.
I think it was actually
Johnny Carson, because what I remember is that, you know, one of the musical acts that they actually had in there, which was really interesting, was XTC. And the fact was that Andy Partridge doesn't play live. And so I still, in retrospect, can't remember if they actually had them in there. They were playing a song acoustically, but I don't know whether or not they actually played in front of the audience or whether or not they actually played in an empty studio and then stuck it in the context of the show. But
good to find out.
Yeah, but I do remember that it came out at the time of Oranges and Lemons, which was 1989.
Yeah.
So that's when that show was around that time of 1989. But in terms of trying to be on, I guess, the political tip, it did seem, at least from my aspect of things, my MTV generation, was that even if they didn't have a show like the current Daily Show or the Colbert Report or stuff like that, they did at least try to, it seemed, branch out in terms of a connection between music and other aspects of the entertainment industry, and sort of bring those together under an umbrella in a way that doesn't resemble how they bring things together nowadays. I mean, now the big joke about the MTV Video Music Awards, of course, has been is why do you continue to have a Video Music Awards if you don't play any videos?
Right.
And literally, I don't know when they do play videos. They did get down to a point where, besides that countdown show with Carson Daly, which barely showed any parts of the videos that were voted on anyways.
Oh, God.
That the only other time that they were really showing things were like late
in, I was gonna
at
say,
night.
I don't have cable, and I have not watched MTV in many years, but the last time I remember watching it for any significant amount of time was probably in 2004, 2005, and I would only ever turn it on after midnight because there would be these maybe half-hour chunks where they would actually show some videos.
Well, I mean, it's not only that. It was the slow creep of the non-video programming. Not only that took over MTV to the point where they actually had created MTV2, and then it creeped over and took over, I think, virtually all the programming on MTV2 as well. And then it did the same with their more adult spinoff, VH1. And now I think the only property they have that either semi-regularly shows videos is VH1 Classic.
Yeah.
Which basically, you know, doesn't show anything that actually is being produced by current people. You know, if you need current videos, you go to YouTube.
And that's another reason why I wonder what iteration of MTV is next.
Yeah.
It will not be video television. It's
no.
not VTV.
No.
It's not PTV. It's certainly not political.
No.
What is it? What's coming next? What is the future of this channel? Is it even relevant anymore? I mean, outside of the couple of really shocking reality TV shows that obviously bring in most of its viewers, what is it there for? Are we seeing exclusive interviews with top talent any more than we are on the other networks?
One of the things where I hold out hope is the fact that even though they don't play videos anymore, the MTV Video Music Awards, I think, had its largest audience this past September when they broadcast it. I think was the largest their largest viewing audience. And what that seems to tell me is that there's an aspect of people out there who are craving anything on the on that channel resembling music. And that if you do give it to them, that there will be an audience. So how they build on that, if they build on that, that's the question. I mean, there is, you know, they could go back, that one of the ways that they could possibly deal with it is now that the people who started out with MTV, our generation, are now probably as old, if not older, than the people that they were building VH1 for when they started that out.
Absolutely.
Is to maybe refocus things into, you know, at least recognizing the fact that there are people who are of an older generation who still have the warm fuzzies for MTV in association with it, and to, if not just give them nostalgia, then to give them an actual block of programming, you know, later in the day, when their target focus group are supposed to be doing their homework.
Right, we'll play to the demographic. I get you.
On MTV, that ain't working. That's the way you do it.
I think another aspect of all this, and it's not necessarily the political aspect, is one very significant recollection I have of MTV back in its time, in its heyday, was its station identifications. When they would cut to, and I'm not just the logo, because yes, of course, they have the iconic logo, but they featured some really exciting and cutting edge station ID.
Well, they got people who were known artists and animators and things like that to create buffers and filmmakers and things
absolutely.
Like that to do that.
And they were cutting edge.
Well, I mean, I think one of the last projects that Keith Haring did before he died of AIDS was, I think, a buffer for MTV using his animation.
And that's very significant. The fact that it was Keith Haring, the fact that a lot of that stuff really spoke to, I think, a lot of the novelty of the 80s even. And a lot of the art of the 80s and a lot of the, even the graphics that we associate with the 80s were so well represented.
Well, remember one of the last projects, one of the last things, you know, notable things that Warhol did is that he got involved in video directing for at least a couple of artists. And so, you know, it was the idea that they were actually working in a medium that had some sort of artistic credibility, the you know, a combination between the old guard and the avant-garde, that type of thing. And that in itself is sort of like a political statement in a way, because the absence of it does say a certain thing about what you look at versus culture versus commerce. And MTV really has made a particular choice on the aspect of commerce as it informs culture, rather than the other way around, perhaps, which is how it, you know, it seems it was more that way earlier on.
And you took the words right out of my mouth. I think that's when they started to really turn. And I think that's when they lost a lot of people in my generation, anyway.
There is a way that you can deal with things that seem to be of trends without simply exploiting them for mass consumption and the spoils that come with it. And it's a fine tightrope that one has to walk between profits and keeping hold of generations that have been sort of built on a base of cynicism and irony and things of that nature.
Well, that's a nice segue into the artists that became MTV darlings themselves. And Nirvana comes to mind.
Yeah.
Because there you had a tightrope walk that one can argue did not end well.
No. I mean, there was always, I think, a great confusion, if not cynicism, within Cobain as to how to deal with the aspect of fame and the aspect of giving your audience what it wants versus giving yourself what you want and, you know, expressing yourself honestly versus sort of the challenge of being able to do that when you have any sort of attachment with, you know, the inner workings of the music and entertainment industry.
And that's just one example. I mean, this idea of authenticity versus accessibility. I remember reading recently in Pitchfork about Brian Eno saying that one of the challenges with working with Coldplay or U2 was that they were always walking that tightrope. They never wanted to alienate their fans, but at the same time, they wanted things to be new and fresh and different. And how do you keep those two things together?
It is really difficult because, I mean, I think one of the most amazing things for me was, at least for my generation, the way I saw it was 1987 was a big awakening year for me. And in terms of the aspects of U2, this is the 25th anniversary of that album,
wow,
of the Joshua Tree. And it really seems amazing in comparison to the fact of what's on the top of the charts right now for the most part.
Oh, God.
And you had a band that made an album that in many ways was a contemporary Christian rock album, which exploded. The first single, With or Without You, I don't know if radio stations have the attention span to play a song like that, mostly nowadays. I mean, just the way the song builds and sort of the almost the turgid moaning of the one guitar lot effect, the Ebow type of effect that goes mm-hmm. on and on throughout the song and things like that. It seems very radical compared to things that actually hit top 40 nowadays and seem to be churned, you know, that have seven writers and six producers and things like that and are, you know, crafted to the edge of their lives and things like that. And a band that was, and continues to be extraordinarily political.
Absolutely, and that's the other side of this.
And it makes an interesting contrast, I think, between U2 and Nirvana was because, for whatever reason, Bono seemed to be as comfortable with the same things and continues to be in terms of what the spotlight means versus what it meant to Cobain.
Versus what it meant to Michael Stipe.
Yeah.
I mean, that's another person who I think of in that, who really, I don't know if exploited the right is the right word, but certainly, I mean, R.E.M. is a band that definitely had great success with their videos.
Yeah.
They were original, they were definitely artistic, and at the same time, this was a band who really spoke to social consciousness.
Mm-hmm.
With many of their videos, with many of their songs, and, you know, not... we've talked about them before and their breakup before, so we won't dwell on that again. But right. I do think that it's important to include them in that pantheon of artists that successfully, I guess, promoted themselves through the medium and were still conscious, still prevalent, still seemed to stick to their guns, built an identity on it even.
Yeah, R.E.M. was a successful version of what a lot of actually rock critics wanted the Replacements to be. And Replacements refused to be. Because Paul Westerberg has always had a history of always knowing when he could take that next step. And people were willing to give him the next step. And to find just the right way to fuck it up. Whether it was them playing on Saturday Night Live and acting like morons. Or having Please to Meet Me come out. And their second album on a major label when they're assigned to, I believe, Sire Records. A subsidiary of Warner Brothers. And they went on, I think, the morning show on K-Rock, and they basically responded to each question with, like, what was the reason you did this? And I think they responded to virtually almost all the questions with something along the lines of, because Tommy's gay.
Oh,
or something like that. To which I think the next day the DJs actually broke the record on the air and said they certainly weren't going to be playing the Replacements.
No surprise there.
At all. But I think with Spin Magazine, who actually around the same time as the Joshua Tree and as Document came out, that Don't Tell a Soul also came out, and Spin was promoting the Replacements as the next biggest band in the world. Something along those lines.
Were we ever that young?
but I mean, you know, the Replacements, you know, they're steadfastly known for, I mean, they're infamous for, actually, their video for Bastards of Young is a camera pointed at a radio, I believe, for the entirety of the song with no cuts.
Oh wow!
and it was the type of thing where I think, in a way, Westerberg I think has more in common Bono than either Michael Stipe or Kurt Cobain, because Westerberg seemed to have as much confidence in what it is that he wanted to do as Bono seems to.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, it is, you could argue that he has more integrity.
Yeah,
not than Bono, but than the other two.
Right, whereas I think it really weighed on Cobain, and I think it was sort of, for Stipe, it was sort of, I think it was a little bit more confusing for him as to, let me just say, it did not seem as natural to Michael Stipe as it was to Bono in order to work the political into sort of the history of the band itself. I mean, I had mentioned before in the first episode,
mm-hmm.
I think, how when they won all of the awards at the MTV Music Awards and anticipating that they were going to, that he wore all of these t-shirts with various slogans on them. And, you know, while it was very effective, you know, one, it seemed at the same time a little bit ham-fisted. And at the same time, you know, it was basically playing to, you know, a very willing audience who, you know, the people out there were probably among those who had basically voted to reward them, which gave them the opportunity in order for him to do that thing. Whereas for Cobain, I think there was much more of a disdain at being part of it, but sort of grudgingly going along with whatever it was that he was doing at that particular point in time.
Videos integrating political messages and how to use MTV as a vehicle. And I think, what's the future? And we've already touched upon that. And I, you know, suddenly the video for Born Free by MIA popped into my head.
Mm-hmm.
It'd be interesting to see how much that video ever got played on MTV, if it ever even got played at all. But I almost, you know, in my brain as I'm crafting these ideas about what music television has been and what it can be. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there were shows dedicated to videos like that? Shows in which people could take apart videos like that, critique videos like that, critique the songs that go with those videos, and have an honest discussion of what the songwriter might have meant and what the video director might have wanted to complement the songwriter with in the particular images that they chose.
Yeah.
I mean, to me, that alone is fodder for a great television show.
Yeah, the closest that MTV ever came to that was actually, you know, actually promoting before the premiere of very mainstream videos with making the video.
And then, all right!
And that was those were mainly, you know, straightforward boy band and rap videos and just showing the process. And it wasn't very successful, I think, because basically it was the same thing over and over and over again.
The same concept or the same...
Because they weren't videos that actually had much of a concept except either dancing or riding around or hanging.
Right. There's a lot of videos that came out in the late 80s, early 90s that had that same grainy Depeche Mode feel, I think. And there was that phase of the videos that were all black and white and maybe just a little bit weathered, so they almost looked like it was archival footage, but not really archival footage.
Yeah, and the alternative to that, really glossy thing was just sort of random intercut shots of the band singing in a studio versus them having a, you know, working it out on the road.
Exactly. Well, that was a big trend especially in the hard rock metal videos.
But on the other hand, I mean, if you want to take a look at it from a political aspect, I think those same people who were making those videos at that same time, you know, there still was an integration in terms of MTV. I remember they had there, you know, when the Soviet Union started opening up and they started having actually Western acts there. I mean, MTV promoted like, I think gigs that I think like a whole bunch of people, you know, from hard rock and metal like Ozzy Osbourne and Motley Crue and Bon Jovi and stuff like went over there and they sort of covered it in a pseudo documentary manner. You know, I know MTV broadcast commercials for Rock Against Drugs.
Oh,
with some of those same things. I think Bon Jovi had one where he was like really kind of all cheesily saying, "Yeah, we know how to have a good time, but one thing we don't do is include drugs."
I seem to recall Vince Neil in an interview saying that he had done a few lines right before he went on.
Yeah.
Right before he filmed his.
But I think they also said that. That was another thing that MTV did, which was more expansive, which was, you know, the Rockumentary series. And that moved over to the VH1 Behind the Music series.
Yeah, which was wildly popular.
Yeah, and that was another thing. It was sort of it was nonfiction in a way, but it was nonfiction as different in terms of reality TV. One, because it actually had a connection to the entertainment industry versus the stuff that they do now. And, you know, I think they actually talked about things that involved issues, like the politics of the group and things like that. That actually is something to talk about. The interesting fact that, you know, that there actually is more than one MTV around the world. In fact, that there's a whole different type of programming on MTV Canada, which is different from another program, Much Music. The other thing is that other countries, of course, and, you know, occasionally we find out through, like, the MTV Video Music Awards, if you watch them or something, that there are other MTVs that give out their own awards. And who won the major award this year? And so there's Asia and Latin America, and then an MTV Europe, and then there's one specifically in Russia, which recently tried to create a sort of a political talk show for teens, and they got canceled after one episode, apparently because they said things that were critical of the Putin-supported government.
Yeah, it was no secret that the host of the show was a big opponent of Putin.
Yeah,
herself.
And so it is MTV as a worldwide unity isn't apolitical. Unfortunately, you know, the most recent story that we were able to find about it was for one where politics actually got them in trouble. Of course, I think I would rather see one episode of a political show than none.
I was going to say, and when I read that article, I thought, wow, poor MTV Russia now has to be more like MTV United States.
Yeah.
Where that wouldn't even be considered, wouldn't even be on the plate. And I question whether it would even get ratings, at least not from the same demographic that's watching Teen Mom.
And that's the thing that I worry about, you know, the the vast influence of corporatism in MTV right now because of it, you know, being simply a subsidiary of such a large conglomerate. You know, they're doing their choose or lose campaign, but they've hippified it for 2012.
Oh, yeah, it's like fantasy football, isn't it?
Yeah, they've actually incorporated things of social media networking and fantasy sports gaming into the process, which does seem, you know, It wasn't like choose or lose was the most hard-hitting thing ever, but at least it didn't seem as dumbed down in comparison as it does when you're actually doing these things. Like, in order to keep our demographic interested, by the way, which is that they're now targeting a demographic that's not old enough to vote yet.
Again, grasping at straws, just trying to find their footing and their identity, and really just missing the mark.
Yeah. It really does seem to me, you know, and again, like I said, like a half an hour or more ago, this may be just me projecting myself onto the situation, but it does seem to me that they may be in the start where it does seem like maybe the Teen Mom thing has gotten too big and too problematic, perhaps, in terms of the infamy of, like, creating celebrities out of an aspect of culture where it was like, you know, you didn't promote yourself if you were a Teen Mom.
I think about asking, you know, as a social experiment, someone our age, how they would describe what MTV is to someone who's never seen or heard of it.
Right.
And asking the same question of even an 18-year-old, to say nothing of a 14-year-old, who might, I would speculate, just call it another channel on cable. Whereas I don't think that's how we would describe it at all.
No. I mean, there is, for people that are around our age group, a real distinct feeling of what MTV is that in no way resembles what it is now. And that's because the channel itself, you know, you have to say it doesn't resemble what it is now, either from whether or not it plays videos is actually when you talk about the definition of it, really a moot point. I mean, a certain, you know, it goes back to the fact that a few years ago they actually removed under the MTV logo music television. And it goes to the fact that you don't have, like, these documentary-type series, and the most you have nowadays is, I think they occasionally still have a real-life something. It's always real-life something, because they have the real-life Zuccotti Parker, real-life occupation they actually did.
Real-world?
Well, The Real World was like their first reality series, but the real life one was actually looking at, like, somebody's life, and what it was like to be that type of person who, you know, maybe was homeless or, you know, had an addiction or something like that. It just seemed that between, you know, expanding the shows that it, because it's so, especially with profit margins maybe being tighter, I don't know, it's so much easier also to make, basically point a camera at something and create reality programming than it is to do things like they did back in the day where they had, you know, game shows and news programs.
It's
and,
a lot cheaper.
Yeah, and various entertainment shows, and they tried talk shows and things like that. And, you know, they had blocks of things that had happened during the day. You know, Beavis and Butthead started there. Daria, they had the really off kilter animation with Liquid Television.
Liquid Television.
You know,
they had 120 minutes, which is a video show, but certainly catered to a certain type of music, and in its own way was pretty cutting edge.
Yeah, the same thing. And UMTV Raps had interviews as much as it did. Play videos.
Sure, I mean Fab Five Freddy was a reporter. He was not just a VJ.
Yeah, and even when they basically moved it to a shorter daily studio show with the other Dr. Dre and Ed Lover, you know, they had people that were in house, and you know, a lot of people who are now are like, you know, part of the rap canon. You know, sort of starting out there, people, you know, are like old school, you know, pioneers, you know, even, and you tend to forget, you know, especially, you know, how hip-hop looks nowadays, is that how quaint some of it actually looks in comparison, especially when you have the fact of, like, you know, you compare, like, you know, on the female point of view, you compare Nicki Minaj to Queen Latifah when she was still Queen Latifah, and MC Light and things of that nature.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a different projection of culture and the diversity of it and things like that. And I don't, at least from what I get of MTV, is how it sort of trickles down to me nowadays.
Yeah.
I don't really see that, because I think there almost is a homogeneity in reality programming where, because it's basically, you know, most of the day people, you know, they have daily interactions and things like that. They tend to act. A lot of times the things that they do on a day-to-day basis are very similar. And if you're just recording and playing those things, then you end up with a lack of creativity. You end up with a lack of anything involving, you know, a political or cultural message. You basically end up with basically a bunch of people talking about virtually nothing. But for some reason, you know, they were able to do things with, like, The Hills and then the Jersey Shore and things like that. With...
Even the Osbournes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know...
That was somewhat different, though, because you had somebody that actually was already famous and seeing what their daily life was like.
Yeah.
And then you moved on to people who were... The only thing that they had in common with the Osbournes is wealth. And
right.
Then seeing what their daily life was. And now you've moved on to people who they've taken the aspect of the Hills, which is people behaving outrageously, and then seeing what their daily life is like. And
I think, you know, it goes back to saturation and saturating the market with a particular product that started off well enough, started off pop with enough popularity, and then just, you know, milking it dry until we move on to the next formula and see if that works better instead or brings us back the numbers we used to have. And that's no different than the main networks. The problem with MTV is, in their own conundrum, to not become a 24-hour channel that's known for one thing.
Right.
I mean, there could be a fashion or style TV cable network. I wouldn't know. I'm not a cable subscriber. And maybe the only thing that TV cable network shows is 24 hours of fashion shows.
Yeah.
Well, it would stand to reason you probably wouldn't be watching that show, or most people anyway, would not be watching that cable network or that particular... I mean, it's like the Weather Channel.
Yeah.
I don't think they wanted to become the Weather Channel of music videos, especially not music videos that, as we mentioned before, might have for a while anyway, all followed the same blueprint.
Yeah.
Because, oh my goodness, I can't think of anything more boring than watching a bunch of strung together montages and black and white grainy footage of, with sepia lighting of bands just in the studio. Cutting off and then cutting away to a woman prancing about on a hill.
I would say this, though, and this may be a good way to sort of focus things towards a conclusion, perhaps, mm-hmm. is that at least back then, if there was some homogeneity, there also were people who were not only writing about MTV, you know, as still, even with the homogeneity, sort of a cutting edge or thing, but in terms of the politics of MTV, when I put up the playlist, you'll notice that there are people who, if they're writing things criticizing MTV, that actually existed. I mean, I don't know of anybody who actually, in the form of a musical commentary, is writing about them. There's nobody writing a song saying, why doesn't MTV play videos anymore?
Well, again, I think that's because if you asked the generation that's making music now, they don't even remember it as only having ever been a music video channel.
Yeah.
I mean, ask the 18-year-old, what is MTV? They'll say it's just another cable network that shows that I like.
Yeah.
They wouldn't necessarily identify it. In fact, I'd be surprised if they identified it as a channel that promoted artists or particular music videos at all.
Yeah, but even beyond that, even as it being a television network focused on music or focused on music and music-related culture or what have you, or any of the incarnations that it was before, there was still, you know, this sort of reaction that came from other people, sometimes very important in terms of being musicians or, you know, in terms of a level of credibility or popularity or two things involving, you know, their opinion either talking or singing about MTV. And nowadays, it's really a moot point. And you get the people to show up for your award show, and then the other 364 days of a year,
they'll go to Colbert.
Yeah.
Or they'll want to.
Yeah. And the and if you want to talk about what the politics of MTV, one, do they care? I think that if money is involved, then politics get involved in some way. Even if it's sort of a socio-political cultural thing in which, you know, there's a boardroom meeting going on and they're saying, you know, how are we going to deal with, you know, our sinking ratings in this area and things mm-hmm. like that. Mm-hmm. But in terms of other extenuating connections towards that, I don't think, at least at this point in time, they are starting, you know, they're now... you know, now that we've passed the 30th anniversary of MTV, they're starting to kind of... They do seem to be maybe going through a little bit of a midlife crisis. They're starting to...
I think they've always been in some kind of life crisis.
Yeah.
You know, I think... And I'll conclude with this. I think MTV will, so far, insofar as it is owned by a large corporation, Viacom, it will react to whatever it is its audience is projecting. I mean, it will continue to pander to its public. And it's up to the public, I think, to change it and to steer it in the direction that it will go. What that direction will be is largely up to whatever the current climate is. And I think that if youth culture were to veer towards a more socially conscious state of mind, I think that the programming will reflect that. If they continue to really inhabit that world of bread and circuses, of sensationalism, and I don't think that it necessarily will for just logically again, because I just think that that we're at a saturation point with it.
Yeah.
I think that MTV will respond in kind.
I think it will. The thing that I do worry about, and this is something that I mentioned earlier on, is because, you know, using the It Gets Better special as an example, okay, they do seem that they may be a little slow on the uptick,
yeah,
a little behind
sure
on the
enough.
Curve, and they have, because they have so many other outlets to challenge them, to compete with them on these issues and on things that could be of interest outside of entertainment purposes, they're going to have to sort of get on the ball in terms of being really willing to put in the effort to get back on the uptick, because...
And to take risks.
Yeah, and to take risks. Because, you know, like I said, if they want to not just dip their toes back in the water, they're going to have to realize that people can quickly go to some other location in order to get the information they want. So they're going to have to compete not just on accessibility, but on quality as well.
Yes.
And so we're going to, you know, it'll be interesting to see going forward if what we both seem to see is a possible change in the tide, a possible crisis of conscience that might be going on, starting to go on as things like, you know, Teen Mom and Jersey Shore get long in the tooth, and possible, you know, other issues making their way back into their programming, how they deal with that, and whether or not they not only become relative, but actually are able to sort of catch the wave again.
Yeah, let's hope it happens sooner rather than later.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good point to actually end this episode. If you have any suggestions for future episodes, please leave us comments, tweet us, let us know, subscribe to the Pop Dose podcast in iTunes, and leave a review there. And so for now, on behalf of myself, Matthew Bolin, and Leanna Fernandez, thanks very much and good night.
Thanks, everyone. Good night.
Making sure nothing's up to the imagination.